Welcome to the Talent Smart Podcast. Our intention in each episode is to interview interesting and inspiring people who will offer their insights into their areas of expertise. We want to explore how technology and business can improve and enhance the world. We're always keen to hear from you and let us know what topics you'd like to hear us cover in future episodes. Also, if you'd like to take part, please let us know. We're always looking for interesting and inspiring people to interview. Speak soon. Hi, everyone. Delighted today. We're going to be joined by the author and a good friend of mine, Gary Lloyd, who's recently written a book called Gardeners, Not Mechanics. We're going to explore a little few things within that. And I'll be asking Gary for some sage advice and seeing where we take the conversation from there. And hopefully there's some hints and tips for you in terms of yourself, your organization, and maybe how you view life. Who knows? So, Gary, thank you first and foremost for joining.
Thank you for asking me. A pleasure.
Quite got off the ground with it, so I'm delighted we're actually doing this today. I suppose the first thing is, with regards to your book, Gardeners Not Mechanics, obviously I know a little bit more than probably some of the people who might be watching this. What prompted you to write it? What was your motivation?
I was running a workshop in the US for somebody's construction firm, actually. Right. And it was their Emerging Leaders Forum, and we had about 30 people, and they'd asked me to come along and talk about a few topics. And in the middle of it, I got, this was a few years ago, I got asked a question. And over the years, I've built up various tools in my toolbox that don't necessarily all fit together readily. You just pull out the tool that you need when you need it, same as you do with DIY. I'm all for DIY, by the way. She asked me a question: how would you approach this problem? And in my head, I had a number of things going off. I had behavioral science, lean project management, design thinking, but I knew that if I started to spurt all the jargon, then I would just completely switch off this room of 30 people who would then start checking their phones and stuff like that. And I started to sweat a little and thought, what the hell am I gonna say? And then I heard myself say, well, I think if you approach it like a gardener, not a mechanic, then that will help you through it. And the room just dropped into silence. And I thought, I'm dead here. I'm half a day through, two days. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina. I've flown there at their great expense to do this. And I thought, so just before I could go into recovery, somebody over the other side of the room said, you need to prepare the soil for what you're doing here. And somebody else said, you need to make sure that you're nurturing it as it grows and stuff like that. And I just sat back, and this was like a facilitator's dream. The room just started to interact, talking about this real problem that the person articulated, and absolutely using analogies to total destruction. And it was great, because whether they believed in the analogy or not, and I do believe in it, as we'll come on to, whether you believe in the analogy or not, pursuing an analogy takes your mind down paths that would otherwise be untrod.
Right.
So I called my wife that night and I said, Gardeners Not Mechanics, it encapsulates lots of things I'm interested in, systems thinking, behavioral science, these kind of things. And she said, well, I think you're onto something. You should write a book. And I never got around to it. And I don't know if you heard, there was a pandemic.
You didn't mention it to me.
And I was sitting at home and I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a book, because I think this would be useful to people. And the other motivation that really spurred that was underlying that was having seen change, organizational change and personal change, done so badly over the years, and people using zombie ideas and failed recipes that were invented 30 years ago are still failing. And I thought, well, I've got a good point of view on this. And I wrote the book to improve the world.
Improve the world. Wow, there's an ambition. Create a movement. Well, on that change, it's interesting because obviously you recently were kind enough to speak for us at Technofresh, and the whole topic of the evening was on change. And we got to hear, you know, from you. I mean, I was keen to explore that a little bit further. So in your opinion, why do change initiatives and projects often fall short of their expected value? What occurred there?
There was a big change that happened in the mid-90s, Phil. When I was, this could show my age now, but when I was at business school in the mid-90s, then the big movement of the time was continual improvement. Toyota had completely reinvented manufacturing through lean thinking. And then in, I think it was 93, a book came out called Reengineering the Corporation. And that was by Hammer and Chompy. And it's really interesting, the metaphor that they're using there, which is re-engineering.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Right? It's re-engineering. So the notion of re-engineering, well, let's think about what you re-engineer. You re-engineer a machine. And what's the characteristics of a machine? Well, a machine is predictable, right? It has the same inputs, produce the same outputs time after time. So that was their model. And they said, I think it says on the cover of the version of the book I've got upstairs, and it says, obliterate everything. So you should start completely from scratch, re-engineering the corporation. And then in 94, a guy called John Cotter wrote a book called Leading Change.
Yeah.
And that's one of the most influential change books ever. It was written 30 years ago. If you go on a training course for change, let's call it change management, because that's the popular term, I prefer to talk in terms of change leadership, but change management, most popular book, consultants still use it, training organizations still use it. It's been failing for 30 years, because as you know from Technofresh, when we put that poll up and we asked people, how often does change deliver its expected value? Then the vast majority of people said 50% of the time or less. People, I've asked that question so many times and people are pessimistic about it. So if Cotter's 8-step sequential top-down recipe is really working, what's the problem here?
Yes, you'd expect that to be a lot higher. I saw the poll and it was quite interesting to watch the room of a very diverse audience as well. So
people laugh, Phil, because they know the answer. If viewer, if you're watching this now, how often do you think, in your experience, in your personal experience, not what you've read, but how often do you think that projects and change deliver their expected value?
Yeah, and it was quite interesting watching the diverse room. And it's, I think it ended up, it was less than 40%, I think, wasn't it? It was in the 40s, low 40s, I think.
I've never seen anybody go above delivers expected value more than 50% of the time. It generally comes out around about 30. And those were in that room, Phil, that was a bunch of senior experienced professionals.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not changed 30 years. The recipe, the cake is still not rising.
And so digging into that a bit, what is the sort of drivers? Is it the fact that everyone's following a flawed method?
I think, I mean, there are lots of reasons why change initiatives and projects fail. We all know that. There's no simple answer. But I think the big reason and the thing that prompted me to write this book is that people are still seeing change as something they do to other people to a great extent, and they're still thinking about organizations like machines. In other words, if you did one, like, you know, in a garden, if you grow something in one place,
yep,
one year, that doesn't mean that the same thing will grow as well in the same place the next year. The environment changes, the soil changes, the whole ecosystem changes. Now, re-engineering and the Cotter model, they're top down, but they're also inclined to big bets, because if the world is predictable, then it makes you more likely to have a project or a program or a change initiative that is planned a year, 2-3 years out in advance. Yeah. And what happened around the same time as Cotter wrote his book was that we started to get the hero CEOs and the hero COOs, and incremental change is too boring for hero CEOs. A CEO wants to come in, this mad notion of the first 100 days that you have to come in and make an impact in the first 100 days. And sometimes they do, but the problem is the change that's made a lasting change? So people have been inclined to big bet, top down, and I would argue that the world isn't predictable like a machine. It's unpredictable like an ecosystem. You know, so what are the characteristics of an ecosystem? Ecosystems are unpredictable. There are lots of interdependencies amongst the parts, and a lot of the parts are outside your control. So this is what the book says, which is that if you want to make lasting change, I believe that we need to think more like gardeners than mechanics.
Okay. And what are the sort of key differences then? I know you call them out in your book, but what are the key differences, just to, for the purpose of this conversation, between a machine and an ecosystem, and relating that to the work environment?
Well, I think predictability is at the core of it.
Right.
So if you believe that the world of work is like a machine, you can figure out what the inputs are, you can plan it out in advance, and then all you have to do is to execute it. But right. If you're a gardener, when you put something in the soil, you don't know how well it's, no matter what your experience is, you don't know whether it's going to grow well in that place at that time. And so what gardeners tend to do is that they run experiments, and they run low risk experiments. You're not going to plant all your veggies around this time of year. You're not going to plant all your veggies and then expect to harvest them all at the same time in, let's say, September. What you do is you run experiments, you try things out, you respond to the environment, which is forever changing. I mean, God knows the pandemic has shown us what an ecosystem the world of work is. So the difference between thinking like a gardener and a mechanic is that a gardener expects unpredictability. And if you've got people in the equation, then it's going to be unpredictable. A car is a predictable machine when it's in the factory. Put a driver behind the wheel and it becomes unpredictable. Put it on the M25 at night and it's raining in heavy traffic, then you've gone from something which is complicated to something which is complex, because there are lots of different people with different motivations, different behavior that are interdependent upon each other, and a lot of it outside control. That's the nature of an ecosystem.
And just digging into that a bit, so for my purposes, what the difference between complicated and complex, can we just sort of explore that for a minute?
Well, the best way is through example. A car is complicated. A car is clearly complicated. I couldn't fix a car. I can hardly lift a bonnet. It's got lots of moving parts, but it's predictable. Complex is unpredictable. In the jargon, different properties emerge. Different things happen. You know, you think you're in one place and then you find that you're in a completely different place. And that's the essence of it. In a machine, all the parts are contained within that machine. Within an ecosystem, much of it is outside your control. And if you think about the world of work, think about the things that are outside your control. I mean, let me stop using the analogy for a while. Customers.
Right.
You know, you know this better than I do at the moment, Phil. You know, customers are human beings with, they behave differently. You can't treat two customers the same. You can't control what they do. That's the nature of an ecosystem.
Excellent. No, I get it now, because it's because I was going to ask you. I actually tagged in your book the unpredictability side of things. I was wondering, how do people who like predictable. So I'm not just tagging all finance people, but the accounts and finance department of a company. You know, if you say to them, we're gonna be like an ecosystem now, and we're gonna be unpredictable. It for some that might come across as a bit, make them jumpy, nervous, and make feel like we're gonna be a bit reckless. But it's not that.
No, it's not. And in fact, if you get them on side and explain what you're trying to do, for your CFO or whoever it might be, taking a gardening approach is better, because what you're trying to do is to get value on a regular basis, usable value, usable business organizational value on a regular basis. You're trying to test your assumptions as quickly and as cheaply as you can do to validate. Often you do a project, you can have a predictable project, it's 2 years, and you don't know whether your assumptions were correct when you try and deliver the value or not until the end of the project, which is, you know, maybe 1, 2, 3 years out. Whereas you have a conversation that says, we're gonna try this, and we think this will deliver value, and we're gonna give you some value in 2 to 3 months. And then we're gonna give you some more value in 2 to 3 months. And then you've got somebody's attention, because they're sitting back and relaxing. Because what happens if you've run out of money? If you run out of money, you've still delivered a lot of value. I mean, there's a really good example. I don't know if you heard about, there's a guy called Ron Johnson, who created the Apple stores and went on to run JCPenney. Okay. And he was the chairman of JCPenney called him the Steve Jobs of retailing.
Okay.
So JCPenney was in a lot of trouble. I'm actually going to reveal my note here. It's got the share price on it. So if people listening want to just keep track of this. So JCPenney once upon a time had a share price of $85, right? It's pretty high. Now they got themselves into a lot of trouble, and they hired Ron Johnson from Apple, where he'd been a superstar. He'd previously been a superstar at a company called Target, from Mervyn's. Really interesting character, Ron Johnson. Degree from Stanford University, the Silicon Valley University, but wanted to go into retailing, and he wanted to start from the bottom up, which is exactly what he did. So $20 the shares when he took over. $20 when it was announced. When he started, the shares went up to $34. What's that, about 50%? Yeah. And then when he announced his plan for JCPenney, they went up to $45. So that's over double what they originally were. 18 months later, he was fired. The shares were at $15. And now you can pick up JCPenney shares for less than a dollar.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
So what happened? So what happened? So when Ron Johnson came in, I think they had about, from memory, about 1,200 stores, JCPenney, massive retail concern in the US. And their stores used to look pretty chaotic. If you remember, we used to have something called Army and Navy stores. And it's just racks and racks of stuff piled up. Their customers love to go to go discount hunting and Woolworths, yeah, much like that. We still haven't got a contemporary one though, Phil. I think that's probably still too old for a lot of people. Anyway, so he came up with a plan, a vision. It's good to come up with a vision. Good if it's a shared vision, better than your own vision. But he came up with a vision. And that vision was to stop discounting clothing, to rebrand as JCP rather than JCPenney, and to have the products organized by brand, not by function.
Okay.
And then he decided that he was going to, and that's when he announced the plan, and people liked that plan. And then he decided to roll it out to 1,200 stores nationwide, completely untested. No checkouts, just iPads. So he'd taken what he'd learned from making Apple the success that it was, and it applied a lot of those lessons to JCPenney. The problem is that the JCPenney customers, they might be Apple customers, but when they go to JCPenney, they expect to go bargain hunting and rifling through lots of stuff. Now, the interesting thing about the store, so then he ended up getting fired 18 months after he started. He was asked in an interview, aren't you going to test anything before you roll it out? By this time, having acquired his status as the Steve Jobs of retailing, he said, it's an actual quote, Apple, we didn't test anything. And this was absolutely not true. They had mock-ups of Apple stores in a warehouse. And because Apple was a completely new venture, each time they opened the store, it was effectively a test. They went incrementally. But he had so much hubris at this point. He just said, that's what we're gonna do. And it was a complete disaster. And the share sales went down and down and down, and the share price went down and down and down and down and down. The irony was that I saw some articles in investment magazines sometimes later, and they said, well, you know, in terms of the vision, he was probably right. And actually, if you look at, you know, those of us that live in the UK will know that what I just described earlier on much looks like John Lewis or particularly Selfridges or somewhere like that. It's exactly what they're like, little stores in stores. And, you know, his vision was that it would be a place to go for a day out kind of thing, where you would go, you would stay, you would eat, and or this kind of thing. So there was nothing wrong with his vision. The problem was that hero CEO.
Yeah.
Got to make an income. Boy, I mean, he had bags of share options, and he had bags of share options, which he gave up at Apple to come and do this. And what people said about it afterwards, a long time afterwards, was if only he'd done a pilot here, got feedback, changed, adjusted as he'd gone, the whole thing might have saved JCPenney. So had he behaved more like a gardener and less like a mechanic, you know, we'd probably be talking about him in the same breath as Steve Jobs now, rather than forgetting that he was called the Steve Jobs of retailing. Exceptionally bright guy, extremely talented. Ron, if you're watching this, I'd share options. I know you're okay. You don't need me. Don't need me criticizing you.
So, Kerry, that has been brilliant. I am really looking forward to our next episode where we're going to dig in a bit deeper about what people can practically do in terms of being more gardener rather than mechanic. But for now, Gary Lloyd, thank you so much. Join us again for episode 2 of Gardeners Not Mechanics with Gary Lloyd.
All right. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Talent Smart podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. We're always keen to hear your feedback. Please let us know your thoughts and what episodes and what topics you'd like to hear us cover in the future. Our intention in each episode is to interview interesting and inspiring people who offer their insights into their areas of expertise. We're keen to hear from you. Please let us know your thoughts and if you'd like to take part in future episodes.